doing.
Am I doing this?
Oh, there we go. And there goes my phone. Sorry. Anyways, hope everyone is doing well. Haven't seen many of you in a while, clearly. Still getting used to all this. Haven't seen a lot of you in a while, probably since the pandemic started, I think. So I think some of you I haven't seen in like 2 years. But I'm alive and well. And I hope you are all also. So when I first got the assignment for this verse, like when I read about it, right, like Johnny just read it, I was like, oh, you know, I have something, right? I thought in my head, I got something. And then, you know, I took a shower and all that. I even had the ending. I was like, I know how I'm going to end this thing. Then I forgot about it because Christmas happened and all that. I forgot about it. Then when I started, you know, towards the finishing of this, when I started to write it, I was like, oh, yeah, I had that thing. And I was like, I don't know if it's going to work anymore. And once I finished writing it, I was like, actually, I think it could work. So I put it back in. We'll see how this goes. We'll see if it works. Here's the story I thought of. So whenever we eat out as a family and go to a restaurant, my oldest son, he's 6, he always asks if they have a kid's menu at this place, right? Or if it was like a spontaneous thing and we're already out like shopping or whatever, and we decide to go to a restaurant, like he'll always ask, like when we sit down, Daddy, like, is there a kid's menu? And he does this without fail. I don't know why, I've never really asked him, but if I were to guess, I would think it's because part of it is so he has something to do when he's waiting for the food, right? You get to color stuff, there's like a word search in there, like a maze, you know, things like that, just fun stuff. But I think another piece of it, though, is not so much that it gives him something to do, but it allows him to participate in the dining experience as a full participant. You know, like there's food that's just like kid size. It's structured in a way where it's like, oh, you usually get like some sort of entree, then you have like a side, like fries or fruit or whatever, and you get like a juice. And you know, he usually sees Daddy order a special drink at dinner, so he would like a special drink as well, you know? So yeah, like why not, right? He wants to be involved in here. He doesn't want to be this individual who is only partially involved in the dining experience, who can't order his own food, has to eat the scraps of whatever mommy and daddy pile on his plate, or it's an adult appetizer and, you know, like it's not really something he even likes. And it's not even his size, and there's no juice or dessert afterwards. So I think that's really it, right? Like it's an experience that's tailored for children. And as someone who's 6, like I still barely regard him as a human being, but he's having human experiences. And even at 6, he has a sense of identity where he knows, like, I'm a kid, therefore, as a kid, I need kid things. I don't need to be a kid shoved into an adult world and sort of just barely hanging around on the edges. I want to be 100% involved in this thing. That's why, I don't know. Like I said, I never asked him. I'm trying to psychoanalyze my kid in front of you, but makes sense, I think, at least for me, having never studied psychology before. So when he asks if these restaurants have a kid's menu, he's really asking, like, do I belong here? Is this a place where I can feel like, you know, like I'm welcome here, essentially? So that's the story that I have. How does this tie into Revelation? We'll see. So Revelation is probably for me the favorite book of the Bible for me. It's a tie between that and Genesis. So the first and the last, right? Like I don't know which one to choose first. But yeah, it's definitely one of my favorite books. And you've probably heard a lot about it before, but don't know what to do with it, right? There's a lot going in the book of Revelation. If you've even skimmed through the pages at all, there's a lot. The imagery is intense. There's like a ton of symbolism. A lot of stuff is abstract. It's not in a linear format. So you can't even follow a timeline of stuff. It's just kind of all over the place. And if you don't understand it, or if no one's ever explained it to you or explained it to you well, it's intimidating. So I don't know, bear with me here, but I would bet that as a result of all this, because it's so confusing, because like there's all this like weird abstract stuff happening, most of us just ignore it, right? Like we know it's there, it's at the end, but like we read it and we're like, whatever. And we just, I don't know, put it away until the next series or whatever, so we don't have to deal with it. And if that's the case, that's fine. Like it's not an easy book to read at all. And because it's not an easy read, a lot of people have tried to theorize and hypothesize on what it means, but in my opinion, they've generally been pretty bad, and a lot of these this kind of interpretation, I guess, has been sort of misguided and misrepresented and incomplete. Most of it seems to be based on some predication of fear, fear of the unknown, perhaps, fear of the future, fear of the end of the world, whatever, but fear. At its worst, it's become a catalyst to help push everything from like a doomsday cult to political agendas. So it's a book that has been weaponized, actually, and kind of used against people due to their kind of not knowing much about it. But what I personally find interesting about this book is that, yeah, there's crazy flying monsters in here with multiple heads, bloody cosmic battles, a lake of fire, the mark of the beast, whatever that is, right? And like, there's all these weird, crazy looking things in here, but within those pages still is some of the most beautiful theology that you will ever come across. And I don't mean beautiful like it's well written and it's like really poetic and things like that. No, it's not the words themselves or how they're structured that makes it beautiful. It's the theology and what God is trying to communicate to us that makes this thing beautiful. And I have roughly 25-ish minutes, 20, I guess, left with you guys. And hopefully I can share and uncover some of that beauty with you. And you can start seeing this book in a new light. But before we do all that, before we jump into Revelation, at the end of the Bible, we got to sort of start at the beginning of it in a little bit. And I'm going to give you a crash course on the early parts of Genesis real quick. So if you guys remember, about the last time I saw you, pre-quarantine, I was up here giving a talk on Genesis. Does anyone remember what I said? No? No, I'm serious, because I don't remember. I was hoping you could tell me. I'm just kidding. Okay, so I was up here, right? If you don't remember, that's fine. It's online. You can look at it later. But in that sermon, I explained that the concept of creation in the Near East, this is Genesis 1, by the way, the concept of creation in the Near East wasn't you took something out of nothing and then you made something out of it, right? It wasn't like you drew something on a white piece of paper and now there's something. Or that like you built something together, like a birdhouse or something, and like, here you go, I created something. It's not like that. The concept of creation back then was about taking chaos and putting order into it. So things that were purposeless, things that seemed to be all chaotic and all over the place, someone organized it, gave them a purpose, gave them function, and it created systems around it to sort of support all that. And you know, rules, structures, systems to operate in. That's what creation looked like. And it kind of looks like that now in some sense, right? Especially for those of you who work with like systems, like engineering, or for me, like in design, like there's systems we do, and we create those systems, and then we make things. Yeah. So it's all about sort of establishing order and then maintaining that order so that everything can function within that order. And that's why to sort of live justly, right? To The word justice in the original language really just means right order. So if you're doing justice, then you're following the order, right? If you're practicing injustice, then you're not. So it makes sense, right? So in Genesis, God created this universe for us to build on and a system for us to operate in so that the order of things would be properly maintained. It was good, and God dwelled with his creation. But then the creation, us, ultimately dwelled with him. But we also found a way to mess that up really bad, not just once, but repeatedly. And instead of building a world where everyone is practicing justice and equality, we did the opposite. We built a world of injustice and oppression. Instead of operating within God's structured order, we decided to create our own. And we established our own rules for us to follow. And we don't even do a good job of that, right? We're like, all right, God, we don't want to do your own rules. We'll do our own thing. And we still break them. So So in short, we couldn't be trusted to maintain this order. And because we couldn't be trusted, Jesus had to come down to show us a better way to be human. He showed us what justice and equality look like by challenging those with power to use it for everyone's benefit, those with wealth to distribute it to those who didn't. And to create systems that will sort of go back to what God was trying to do with his original order. So that's that, right? Crash course in Genesis. Okay. Revelation 21, which is what we had here previously. What does this have to do with that, right? What is my kid eating out, wanting kids menu, the beginning of the world, and then this thing have to do together? All right, I think we can start stitching it now. So in this first part of the verse, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away and there's no longer a sea. You can leave it up here, actually. Without context, it seems fairly straightforward, right? Yeah, like a new heaven appeared and the old one and the old earth like passed away. Okay, great, like not too crazy there, right? But the questions are, why is there a new heaven and a new earth? And why did the first earth have to pass away? What was wrong with it? What was wrong with it is because we destroyed it, essentially. God created an environment for us to thrive in and to inhabit and rules to operate in. We decided to not do any of that. It's like sin permeates throughout the world now. So for humans then to sort of follow this order and to live justly, we can't do that in an environment that's sort of, it can't support that anymore, right? Like there's just sin in this environment. And it's unsustainable. So while Jesus died for our sins, what that did was it established the relationship again that we had with God, right? We have a direct channel back to God, but it doesn't do anything to the habitat. The habitat is still rotten. And if God wants to dwell with his creation again, just like he did at the beginning of the Bible, you know, when he was walking around the garden with Adam and Eve, like he can only dwell in places that are holy, and currently the environment we have is not that holy. So the only alternative then is to create a new one where sin has not destroyed it, and it's completely devoid of it. Yeah, next slide. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down of heaven, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. Okay, so in this verse, we sort of see what that new environment will look like. It's a euphemism here, but it's a city coming down out of heaven. And read that again. It's a city coming down out of heaven. Why is that important? And you could check, this is the NIV, I think, but you could check all your other translations. The city comes down from heaven. God comes down to us. Heaven comes down to us. This should be interesting to all of you because we've all been taught that when we die, we like magically float up to heaven, right, in the clouds somewhere. But it's not written anywhere in the Bible, but we all think this. And instead, this happens, the opposite. We don't go to heaven. Heaven comes to us. Just like it did when God created the first order of things in the Garden of Eden. God came down to us. So this is basically a recreation of things that previously was. And Jesus would later do the same thing, right? When Jesus comes down to us in the form of a baby, that's heaven again, coming down to us. God's domain meeting our domain. And Belinda Carlisle was right all along. Heaven is a place on earth. I'll try not to do that ever again. Sorry. Okay. And then Jerusalem, right? Sorry. Stay here, please. So Jerusalem comes down, and Jerusalem is mentioned as being important because Jerusalem is the first and only city where God said, hey, like, build a temple here, and this is going to be a channel for us, for humans and God to interact, where heaven and earth come together. But it's very controlled, right? It will only exist in this temple, and there's a whole bunch of rituals that we have to follow in order to make both the temple clean so that the environment is suitable and holy enough for God to hang out in, and for the people to interact and talk to God. They have to go through a bunch of rituals so that they're clean and holy and devoid of sin, so that God can talk to them without killing them. So that's that, right? But it was confined in this box, in this temple. It's a very pretty box, but it's still just there, and mostly inaccessible except to priests. And even so, there was a whole bunch of stuff you had to do in order to get that communication going. But what's fascinating, though, is further on in Revelation, when the author of this book is kind of further describing the physical details of this new Jerusalem, the author mentions that there's actually no temple in it. The temple usually is in the middle of the city. It's quite tall, so you could see it because it's on top of a hill. Anywhere you walk around Jerusalem, you could see it. There's this massive thing just coming out of the hill somewhere. But in this new city, he's looking around. He's like, I don't see it. And it's not here because what was the temple in the first place? It was a place for God to hang out and establish a line of communication. But if heaven itself is coming to earth, then that's everywhere, right? This whole new Jerusalem is basically that environment. So why would we put God back into a box and say, okay, like you, okay, cool, that was heaven. Now it's here, but we're going to still put you in the temple? No. So because of that, there's no temple. All of it is the temple, and God's presence is everywhere at this point. Okay, verse 3. Okay, and I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be with his people, and God himself will be their God. So basically just summarizing everything that we've discussed so far, right? So heaven coming down to earth, God dwelling with his people. God's habitat and ours will combine and become one. But it won't, and again, it's not us going up into the sky, like heaven is coming down to us. Growing up, I heard like a phrase in church before. I don't know where I heard it from, but I think it's a well-meaning phrase. It was like something like, you know, God always meets us halfway. We just got to meet him the other half. But I don't know, man. Like reading this stuff, reading other stories in the Bible, seems like God is doing most of the heavy lifting here. I would say like 99% of the lifting. We just have to do that 1%. And even that 1% seems to be really difficult sometimes, you know? Okay. But God does this repeatedly, right? This heaven coming to earth thing I've mentioned, like the Garden of Eden, Jesus coming. But it's happened a whole bunch of other times. God coming down to earth to meet us, like Moses on the burning bush, God whispering to Elijah in a cave, blinding Saul on the road to Damascus, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This happens a bunch. So number 4. Next slide, please. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, mourning, crying, or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. So again, talking about order, structure, and things like that. The one that we created for ourselves, not a good one. So it has to go, and it needs to be replaced by something else, this new city coming down. And what is this new city about? Well, we know there's no temple because God's presence is going to be everywhere, But it's a city where there's none of this stuff. No death, mourning, crying, or pain. So what's the opposite of those, right? Life, laughter, joy. Sounds like an awesome place to be. So those systems of injustice and oppression that we built, gone. The systems that enable the rich to sort of get away with their corporate crimes while those who are poor continue to suffer in a cycle of poverty, that's gone too. Such things don't exist in this new creation because it can't exist. Like sin is not there. There's no place for it to operate. Sounds great, right? Okay, and then we're going to go now to the crux of all this, which is the feast of this. It's called the Feast of the Lamb, but really what it is, it's the union of heaven and earth. So if we can jump into the next slide, I believe it's Revelation 19:9. This is what was assigned to me. When the angel said to me, write this, blessed are those who are invited to the wedding supper of the Lamb. And he said, these are the true words of God. So as followers of Jesus, we have a divine invitation to this union of heaven and earth. And the book of Revelation describes it basically as this. It's a wedding. Not just a wedding, but a wedding feast. So we're all invited to this. And we're not invited as plus ones because, you know, our significant other knows the people getting married or one of them getting married. We're not invited as B-list people. I don't know if any of you have been a B-lister on a wedding before, but it's not fun, right? Like, all your friends have been invited. And you're like, hey, I know this person too. And they're like, why wasn't I invited? And then you talk to that person, and they're like, oh, you know, it's a small event. It's only just friends and close family. Yeah, sorry. I was like, but why are these guys going? And then a month later, you know, he calls you. He's like, hey, actually, we have an opening for you, so come. I was like, oh, okay. And you get the invite, and it usually says something like, Mr. and Miss so-and-so graciously requests the honor of your presence, and blah, 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 right? It was like, what, you didn't like my presence like last month? Like anyway, so like to me, it's better not to just invite me, right? It's fine. I really don't need to go that bad. But for those of you who've been to a wedding, which I imagine is a lot of you, you know what it's like. It can be a very beautiful thing, watching two people in committing their lives together in a public declaration of love, and it's very, you know, sentimental, emotional. Sometimes the people in the audience cry more than the bride and groom themselves. Like my wife. But if you're like me, the highlight of the whole wedding procedure is the banquet. Itself. It's free food, hopefully an open bar, the chance to see family and friends you haven't seen in a while, as well as those that you see all the time. You know, they're now dressed up. Personally, I really enjoy the social aspect of it. And to me, because I'm older now, it's gotten to the point where I don't even go to the ceremony anymore. I just go to the banquet, you know. And then if I ever get asked about it, like if someone goes, oh, hey, Simon, I didn't see you at the ceremony. I was like, oh, no, I was there. I was in the back. And I was like, oh, did you like it? I was like, oh, yeah. It was really great when they got married. You know, it was awesome. So what's awesome about this particular wedding, though, is that there's beauty to be found in all of it. So if you like to see the marriage ceremony itself, and you like the sentiment of what it brings, and you find beauty in that, like how much more beautiful is it witnessing this permanent union of heaven and earth that we've been discussing? If you're like me and you like the social aspect of the wedding, how much more awesome would it be to sort of catch up with family and friends that passed away in the old order of things and see them in their new glorified selves? That's the type of party we're invited to. As distinguished guests of honor, not B-listers, as VIPs. The closest example I can give about receiving VIP treatment was this one time the company formerly known as Facebook expressed interest in me to join their design leadership team. And they threw a big party. As part of their recruitment strategy. They paid for my lift, they rented out a private restaurant, or a restaurant with a private room in the back. There's free food, there was an open bar, there's a multi-course meal, there's wine pairings with that meal, there's dessert, then there's dessert wines. It was awesome, it was great, right? In that moment, I felt like I had achieved success in this industry, and I deserved to be here. I worked hard for this, and now this mega company that everyone wants to work for is throwing money at me, and I did this. I earned this. Awesome. Good job, Simon. Good job. But full disclosure, I wasn't the only one at this party. There are like 20 other people there. Some of them, I'd say like half of them work for Facebook, half of them don't. And as the night went on, I got to chat with some of these outsiders, right? And I was like, wow, some of them are pretty accomplished. Far more than me, far more. And maybe I'm actually not that special, dude. They have fancier titles than I do. They lead bigger teams than I do. They generally just have more bullet points on their resume than I do. And instead of feeling like, wow, yeah, I'm the VIP, I deserve to be here, I'm like, why am I here? so like that, right? Like in the span of 2 hours, I was riding this high, and now I'm like questioning my own identity. So what started out as a very VIP experience ended up being an exercise in checking my ego and insecurities. And I don't think that's what this is describing. Blessed are those who are invited to this event, this wedding supper. I think it's the exact opposite of that. And I know my story, right, like the one I just told you is maybe a little bit unrelatable, and I understood that as I wrote this. But the details may be different, but I'm willing to bet that a lot of us have still been in a similar type of situation, right, where you need to justify your presence. Am I supposed to be at this party? Am I supposed to be in this friend group? Like, why wasn't I invited to this thing? Like, you should invite me. Like we're always finding ways to justify our presence or inclusion for something. Or maybe it's the tendency to constantly compare yourselves to other people. This person has worked at this job less years than I have, but why is he ahead of me? Or we're doing the same job with the same amount of experience, why is this person making more? Or even if you're the one who's in the superior position, it's easy to look down, like, haha, like we're the same, but I make more than you. And it's like this, right? And having to constantly highlight your skills and achievements and what services you can provide to random groups of people, this is basically like most of our social interaction, if we're honest with each other. But inclusion into this wedding supper isn't about your merit or how much better you are at something than someone else. You're invited here because this is where you belong, and you've always belonged here. So Revelation can be incredibly confusing, but the core message contained within is surprisingly simple, right? Ever since the beginning of time, God has just always wanted one thing, is to dwell with his people. But as humans, we usually just want to dwell elsewhere. And when it's all said and done, like, God's going to get his way. There's going to be a union of heaven coming down to earth. Creation will be reborn. Things will kind of look the same, but also different at the same time. And we get to witness all of that. Not only do we get to witness this, we get to participate in it because we're the guests of honor. This is happening because of us. And it's not because we did anything fancy. It's just because we happen to believe the words of what's written on these pages, that they're the true words of God. So, yeah, there's a wedding happening. And at this wedding, I imagine there'll be a banquet. And there's a banquet with food, drink, friends, family, all that good stuff. And at this banquet, I imagine there's also going to be a table. It's probably a really long table or a bunch of tables. I don't know. I'm just using my imagination here. But there will be a table. And at this table, there will be a seat for every single person who RSVP'd to this divine invitation. And on that table, in front of their seat, is going to be a placard. And on that placard will be your name written across it just for you. And possibly a kid's menu. So during our time of communion, we're going to have a song of reflection and response. Due to technical constraints, I think we'll be muting this part of the live stream, so it'll just be mute for you guys. But if you want to follow along at home, the song that we'll be reflecting to is Divine Invitation by Something Like Silas. So let's do that here now.